This episode of the Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico podcast is brought to you by Spectacle Eyewear. Now, if you've been watching any episodes of this podcast on our YouTube channel, you might have noticed I've been wearing some pretty cool specs lately. Well, you know where I get them? Spectacle Eyewear, 505 Tremont Street, Boston, Massachusetts. Their phone number is 617-542-9600. Head down to Spectacle. Go visit our friend Paul. You'll get yourself some cool specs. Welcome to Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. We started you off today with a great song from the Family Township. We played this one a couple episodes ago. It's called Young Blood. Fantastic song. It's from the November 2023 album, 20th Century Wasters. An album so good that I'm ready to go back and redo my top 10 selections from 2023. Fantastic record. Today, we're joined on the show by the man behind the lyrics and the co-writer of the music, singer and guitarist Mark Pananski. We also get into a band that Mark played in before Township that seemingly was ready to take over the world, that being Runner and the Thermodynamics. So stay tuned for that and hang on, and we'll be right back. Being the big vinyl lover that I am, I'm proud to tell you about Joe's Albums in their two locations. The original shop at 317 Main Street in downtown Worcester, Massachusetts, and their second location out in Western Mass at 5 Market Street, Northampton. Both of these shops are loaded with both new and used vinyl. It's hard to walk in either shop and walk out empty-handed due to their amazing collection of records and other cool goodies like t-shirts, mugs, posters, etc. If you can't find what you're looking for in the retail stores, check out their website, joesalbums.com. Thank you, Joe, for being so cool. And there it is again, that Dogmatic song. I love rock and roll. Yes, we do. We're getting closer to relaunching the Mirror Stars podcast. We're going to keep playing that song until we actually get the show out. It's coming soon, I promise you that. We're working on some technical stuff right now to make that happen. Speaking of the Dogmatics, their documentary, The Dogmatics, A Dogumentary, tells the story of a group of childhood friends and how the survivors are still making music. It has been an official selection of several film festivals, including the recently wrapped Independent Film Festival in Boston, where it had a sold-out screening. There's also another major screening of the film coming on March 15th at the Regent Theater in Arlington. In fact, that's a really cool theater. Arlington, of course, is very close to Cambridge and Somerville and even Boston. The Dogmatics were on this show, episode 182, back in November 2022, a little over a year ago. That was a fun one. You might want to go back and check that out if you haven't listened to it already. And FYI, we're in talks to get the band and possibly the director of the Dogumentary on this show before the March 15th screening. So that's something to look forward to. The Dogmatics are truly a family band. How about this segue? Whether it be siblings or lifelong friends, they're a family band, just like this band, The Family Township. Mark Pinanski, our guest today. When I spoke with Alex, or Alejandro Necochea, guitarist of Township, Family Township, Alex also plays in Worshipper. He's been on the show. He's co-founder of Bang Camaro. He told me I should talk to Mark, and I already had Mark on my radar and I wanted to get Mark on the show, but Alec just went on and raved about what a great musician he is. And I kind of knew that from Runner. You know, Runner was a great band, Runner and the Thermodynamics. They could have been huge, and we find out, you know, some of the reasons why. It happens sometimes. Bands just go certain distance and then something goes wrong. Mark is another Boston guy. You know, he's been at it for a long time. Truly high level of songwriting, and Township is another example of that. They have a bunch of records out, and this new record is really good. From top to bottom, it's a superb effort. Okay, I think I've said enough. I think it's time that we get to it. So here I am with Mark Pinanski. Welcome to those of you watching on YouTube. This is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. If you want to hear this entire show with intros, outros, and music, please go to Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, etc. Please welcome to the show, Mark Pinanski. Did I say that right? Pinanski.
Yeah, you nailed it. I still can't teach Siri how to do it. That's always fun.
I think I originally had the second N left out, and I was going Pinanski.
No, yeah. That's a common one. You're not alone.
Before we talk about this fantastic new Township record, 20th Century Washers, I was hoping we could go back a few years. Like, I'm curious where you grew up. Are you from Massachusetts or?
I am. Yeah, I'm a local guy. I'm a suburban guy. Until I was about seven, I was in, or seven and a half, I was in Sudbury. And then we moved over about 3 miles into West Concord. And I was there through high school.
I know Sudbury
so,
a little
yeah,
bit.
I'm local.
I know Sudbury a little bit because I went to Framingham State and I remember going to some parties out there. It's kind of a farmlandish kind of rural area.
Yeah. It seems like, at least at this point still, they haven't like overdeveloped it. So there's like a lot of wood. It's like you'll see I drive through it a lot, and there's a house, but there's like a ton of woods all around it. It still looks kind of like, so it feels like the 1700s, or whatever, colonial times still, to me at least, certain sections.
I think it's a cool place. I mean, from the times I was there, it seemed like really nice out there, an escape from the city,
Yeah, and it's not that far either. It's like a 25, 30 minutes to Cambridge, or if you go the other direction to Lowell or Worcester.
Yeah, I never took that back road. I know when you're on Route 2, there's a sign that says Sudbury, and I always wondered, I mean, how would you get to Sudbury from there? But it must be right through the woods or something.
Yeah, it cut straight through. Yep.
Did you come from like a musical family?
Yeah, kind of, definitely. My dad was not professionally, but he always played music. I mean, I suppose when he's younger, he kind of dabbled professionally a little bit. But so it was always, from my earliest memories, he had a band, like a classic rock cover band, and they would practice at our house. So the basement was always fully set with music, and I'd fall asleep every Thursday night or whatever it was to them practicing. And we had a piano in the house, and they kind of everybody kind of had to take piano lessons, and so it was definitely a musical family. I was
Yeah, that's.
listening to music and just kind of instruments to pick up, and my dad could get us started at least before we would take lessons from somebody else.
Did you have siblings to play too?
Yeah, it's just I have a sister. She played piano. I mean, she's 3 years older than me, so I kind of wanted to do whatever she did. So I probably started piano a little earlier than she did because I wanted to do what she was doing. I mean, she didn't pursue it that far, but she was good at it.
The classic rock that they were playing downstairs, I know some of it rubbed off on you because I've been hearing ever since, even Runner, I've always heard Thin Lizzy in your music.
Oh,
So
yeah.
I'm imagining they're like one of your favorite bands. And I was going to bring that up with, well, were they one of, they must have been one of your favorites.
Absolutely. But it's funny, like my introduction to Thin Lizzy came sort of later in life, because my dad's band was playing more ZZ Top, from anywhere from ZZ Top to like Huey Lewis, or the Eagles, or Dr. John, like all sorts of stuff. But they Thin Lizzy I found on my own. Like, I knew of the band, but it wasn't until I was about 19, I think, I bought a cassette that was when they were a three piece. It was the Vagabonds of the Western World, and
Oh.
it just sort of it hit me, because I was kind of really trying to focus on lyric writing in rock and roll, and so it's funny, I came at it that way, and then all the harmony guitar stuff that I started to really slam into Township came, second in my Thin Lizzy phase. But the first part of it was really like kind of just Phil Lynott listening to how he writes and how they could tell a story, I guess, in the rock format.
I'm showing my age a little bit now, but I saw Thin Lizzy twice in concert. The first time, I always tell people the story, I was like 15 or 16, and I saw Thin Lizzy open for Queen. And it was like a show I will never, ever forget. Phil had that mirrored bass that he played. And I remember we were like, wow, he's shining the mirror at us. He's shining his guitar at us. And then odd as it sounds, I saw them open for the Outlaws.
Oh, wow.
Which was like guitar from heaven. Your fellow awesome. Bandmate Alejandro would have loved that. There was so much guitar going on. It was like between the two bands, I think there were five guitars.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, that's a guitar player's dream.
So before Thin Lizzy, what were you listening to a lot of music then?
Yeah, I mean, my journey through music, I guess, really quickly was, I think the first thing that I sort of, you know, my pal, actually Peter McLean, who played with us in Township for, you know, over 10 years, we actually met in fourth grade. So he was the first one that he had older brothers, and he kind of, and he was already playing drums, I think, in fourth grade. So I asked him, like, you know, what's this Led Zeppelin band? He's like, okay, get Led Zeppelin 4. That's a good place to start. So I got that cassette, and that kind of, you know, that blew my mind. That kind of changed everything. And then I think the next year in fifth grade, I was like, what's this band Rush? Like, what's it? He's like, all right, we'll start with Fly By Night. So I got Fly By Night, and that, so I was pretty much like Zeppelin and Rush for a little, you know, a good while. And then hair metal kind of crept in, but I liked the kind of harder stuff. I liked that first Guns N' Roses record. I didn't really go in for too much Poison or Bon Jovi or that sort of stuff, but I was in, you know, middle school, sixth grade at that time, so it was unavoidable, you know, in those power ballads. I think that's where I really got the love for the power ballad too. It was probably through that stuff.
So imagine you listen to the BCN a lot.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Actually, I won Mega Mystery Riff once when I was probably 11 or 12. You know, I was supposed to be asleep. It was like a school night, and I'm just listening on my clock radio, and the riff was like Sunshine or Love or something super simple. I think it was Sunshine or Love, and the person got it wrong. And I was like, you got to be kidding me! So I just, like, I took the phone and I hid under my blankets and I called in and I won, and they were good. They let me, you know, even though I was young, my dad drove me in. I got my prizes. I got my Mellencamp tickets and T-shirts and all sorts of fun stuff. So yeah, a lot of BCN. Yeah, I gave them to my sister. I wasn't really into Mellencamp.
Did your sister end up playing in bands or anything?
No, she kind of took the different route. I mean, she got into more like art and painting, and then kind of went to more academic route. So I was the one who just sort of thought, oh, I just got shot with a Nerf gun. Okay, all right, back upstairs. Oh my god.
That's okay. I'm expecting my cat to make an appearance sooner or later. Yeah. He usually does.
All right. That's your one interruption you're allowed. Come on, seriously, upstairs. Thank you. Oh, my God. Okay. Okay. Very good. Very good. So I was the one who sort of kind of really went and just followed my dreams into oncoming traffic, as my friend Mike Vasquez likes to say.
Did you say that your father was a guitar player also?
Yeah. Yep. He could, you know, he could play a little drums and keys and stuff like that, but he was guitar player. In his band, he was mostly rhythm guitar, a little lead and keys. So, yeah. So
Did you get a guitar at an early age because of that?
I did, sort of. So he's a lefty and I'm a righty. Ooh. So I couldn't pick up any of his, but he got a guitar for the singer in his band who played mostly acoustic. He got a deal on like a Fender Lead 2, which is like a stripped down sort of Strat. So it's like maybe 3/4 size or something. So that was around, and that's what I pretty much learned to play on. And eventually the singer in his band was just like, yeah, that's your guitar.
Oh, that was nice of him. So how old would you say when you started doing that?
I think I learned my first chords when I was around 10. I learned my E, D, and A, kind of trying to do it for some sort of form of satisfaction. But, you know, my fingers were really small. It hurts like anybody practicing. It didn't come as naturally as drumming did. So I kind of put it down a little bit and focus more on drums for maybe like a year or so. But I always sort of strummed away. And then I think when I was around 11, I started to kind of get more serious because I wanted to play. I had a band kind of when I was in fifth grade.
I was going to ask
I
you
really
that
only knew those
question.
chords.
Yeah, that was my next question. So fifth grade, was it like a serious band or?
Well, it was again with Peter from Township. And no, when my friend Seth from down the street played bass. No, it was more a band and idea. I mean, we played Twist and Shout with our school chorus and then kind of jammed around a bit more. But it was with the idea of it was serious. I mean, we were 10. So.
When did it start getting a little more serious for you?
Less than a year later. When I was, by the time I was 11, like I was growing my hair long and I was just all in. And I think I was doing both, but I was playing drums, I think at that point in a band, because there seemed to be more guitar players who were like 12 and 13 and there weren't enough drummers sort of. So, I switched to drums for a little bit, but, yeah, pretty much that was it. I was never without a band from that point on. And I think I started kind of trying to write my own songs around 11 or 12.
Yeah, you have an incredible library of songs from Runner, or going all the way back, to Runner. Before Runner, was there other bands?
Yeah, my high school band we were called Slow Children, and that was a fun band. And I would say like kind of the two big takeaways or three big takeaways from that band is one, we got to play the Rat, which I'm excited about.
Did you guys have
First
a
time I played
seven
TT
inch?
Blues.
Did you have a seven inch single?
Not that I know of. I mean, I know they kind of like, we were primarily like a ska band. Like that was still like, that was kind of really big at the time. And we tried to go a bit more of the traditional route. And no, we put out a CD and there were some things on compilations, but I don't think we put out a seven inch.
I remember that band. I mean, what year was that about?
That's going to be probably 90, I want to say 94 to, or maybe 93 to 97, or
Yeah.
somewhere in there.
I was not living in Massachusetts then, but I don't know. That name sounds familiar. I don't know why, but I remember a band called Slow Children.
Oh, yeah. We may not have been the only one, that's for sure.
But you did have a CD out. Was that your first experience at recording?
In a studio, yeah, it was. I think about it. Always doing home recording. I got a four track since I was about 11 or 12. So we always do it. And then I think in early high school, we would rent, like, you could rent like reel to reels from, like, I think Daddy's or Wurlitzer or somebody. So we would do that. And then at some point, I think very end of high school, we went into the studio. So that was my first experience. And that was awesome.
So you played the Rat. Did you guys do any out of town dates, or were you just sticking close to New England area?
Just New England. I think the furthest out of town would have been like Connecticut or something like that. But I definitely did that with that band. I got my taste of the clubs, played TT's for the first time. And so then I was really starting to get a feel for it. So me and my friend Jason kind of broke off from that band and we had a band called the Zips for a few years, about 3 years. This is before Runner. And we really like that. That's where we really kind of went for it. We really focused on songwriting and just living the dream, kind of like just living and writing songs and playing gigs and throwing parties and kind of just living it. And it was great. It was awesome. And I think we were a pretty good band. But towards the end of that, I wasn't the primary songwriter in that band. My friend Jason was, and my confidence kind of was growing throughout that. Like, hey, I learned a lot from him. So kind of towards the end, I was like, okay, I'm ready to kind of try my own thing. And that's when I started Runner. I had joined at the same time a band called the Statue Factor from the South Shore, and they were playing. So the Zips were like very Britpop kind of oriented, sort of like Stone Roses and kind of Blur, Stone Roses, Smiths, Blur, like that sort of stuff, but heavier on the guitar. And then this other band, the Statue Factor, was like kind of like Fugazi, Nation of Ulysses, like oh. really angular, like, and I really connected with that energy, and I liked a lot of Ian Savonius's lyrics and things like that. So I kind of like the fusing of those two worlds. Like I grabbed the rhythm section from the Statue Factor, and we became Runner in the Thermodynamics.
And I'm thinking that was around 2000.
Yep.
Yeah, yep. I saw Runner in the Thermodynamics. You guys were a very energetic three-piece band. I remember that band. There was a big buzz too. I want to talk about that. I think the first thing you did was like a four-song EP.
That sounds about right.
And it immediately had a buzz in Boston.
Yeah. Yep. You know, once it kind of caught, it was pretty quick, I would say. Yeah. Because I think the first year or so, we were kind of finding our thing, and then we switched up bass players and made a recording and just kind of, I mean, it honestly, that band or just the idea of it, and particularly before Mike joined, me and Roger, the drummer, like we were just all of one mind, and really, it really clicked. So once it started to kind of, once people started to catch on, it was like, it went pretty quickly.
It did. And, you know, the band got a lot of attention, probably more from the self-titled record, mm-hmm. Ace Foo Records.
Yep.
Yeah, I remember because you guys were on the cover of CMJ Magazine. And I was like, wow. You know, I had moved to Boston from L.A. and I was managing bands at that time. But they weren't all Boston bands. But I was paying attention to what was going on. And I remember that you guys were on the cover of CMJ, that you went to South by Southwest. I read some old reviews to refresh my mind. I found reviews that were really good in Chicago Reader, Austin. What do you think happened with Runner? Because it seemed like you guys had it all together. You had the band, you had the songs, you toured, you had the buzz. What went wrong?
That's a great question.
Something go wrong?
No, I think definitely a bunch of things sort of went wrong. Sort of just more, mostly I think in a personal mismanagement sort of way. In literal management, our managers were young and hungry, and everybody sort of threw all their resources into it. And the goal was kind of like to get us a nice solid record deal. And when that wasn't happening, one of our managers, we had three of them, he owned that label, Ace Foo, or he's part owner, and it was a cool label. I mean, they had some Ted Leo on there, and like a bunch of, it was a very cool label. So he's like, okay, we'll put it out, and then we'll go from there. But then the label, they carried on for a few more years, but they started to kind of have trouble. I think, you know, part of getting a big kind of quick is like egos a little bit, and started to have, you know, me and Mike, the bass player, started to kind of butt heads a bit, kind of lifestyle choices and things like that. And, you know, we were young. So looking at it now, it's like, well, you know, I wish I could have talked these things out or worked these things out. But instead it was sort of like, no, we got things going, you know, hit the road. And so immediately it kind of, as things were taking off, we changed the chemistry of the band a little bit, and we're a three piece, and that kind of matters a lot when you switch out one player. And we continued to like do bigger tours and all that sort of stuff. We added Jim Zawadowski. But then, you know, that wasn't really working out. And I think at that point, like, I mean, if I'm being honest, I think kind of depression started to kick in, and it I could use it as a creative tool for a while, but I think as more of the broken heart was starting to creep in, like, you know, I don't kind of lost our way a little bit with the band. Everything seemed to click, like I was saying, like it all made sense. And some of the tours kind of confused us a little bit, I think, of as who we were as a band, if that makes any sense. Like, we're touring with Alice Cooper at one point, and then like and then Drive By Truckers and these bands, and I couldn't figure out, like, who were we, where did we fit into this? Because really, we kind of made our name in the sweaty club shows, and I think we put on really good shows in those bigger arenas, but the path was a little murky, I think, and I didn't know what to do, and we started moving away from each other because it kind of got to that point, but like, oh, well, we can get together when it's time to rehearse and tour, and that kind of got to be a hassle. We weren't all in the same area, and so I think it was all just a slow kind of trajectory of, well, it wasn't a trajectory, I think.
The opposite of a trajectory.
Yeah, I think it would have been nice to have someone like a manager or somebody, or even just a good friend who kind of was close to the situation to sort of like lay it out and help us navigate through it. But like, I cared so much about that band. It was, you know, it was my life. And I was having a tough time trying to figure out what comes next, and was it falling apart? And yeah, so I think it just sort of, I just had to kind of pull the plug on it.
In your defense, you know, because I remember that period, if starting in around 2000, the middle of 2000, 2010, the music industry was in complete disarray. All the labels were folding. You probably had a booking agent that was like taking any tour that you could get that seemed like a good tour, because who would turn down an Alice Cooper tour? You know what I mean?
And, sure. But
the depression thing, I can relate to that too, man. You know, if things all don't come together and you're not feeling good, or even if they do come together, you're not feeling good, it can lead to issues. There was a single, I think, that ended up coming out later on. Was that something that had already been done, or did you guys reunite?
We reunited. I think if I'm remembering correctly, because we did play a few times afterwards, but it was for TT's kind of closing shows. And before the band kind of, before I pulled the plug on the band, Mike, the bass player, actually came back and for a while to kind of finish this rock opera that we had done. So we had mended our ways, even though shortly thereafter Mike moved to Los Angeles. But so we were kind of back to our original three and kind of at peace with each other. So when the TT's thing came up and Randy asked us, because TT's was instrumental, it might have been the biggest part of how we got to where we got, because of the shows that we played there, and then getting on better and better shows and building a following, was always in that room pretty much. I mean, we played everywhere, but like the bigger names that we were playing with and making an impression on were in that room. So when Randy asked us if we would get together to play that final night or the final nights, we were sure. And Mike said, well, you know, let's record a couple songs. You know, I've got a song. So that was different, because I wrote everything on the runner stuff, and Mike, and I was really happy to be like, yeah, you know. So I wrote lyrics and melodies to his song, and then we recorded another song that we always really liked and always went over really well live, but never had a chance to record. So we did make a couple of new recordings kind of post-mortem.
You know, you mentioned Randy Millman. As far as Boston goes, she's my all-time favorite booking agent, because she would do exactly what you said. If you brought some people in and you showed you were doing your thing. She would put you on good shows. She did that for me on a lot of bands. She's really was, I know she's got a new thing going on right now. And, you know, she, that I agree with you, man. TT's was really, to me, like, I'd say the premier spot for a band at that level, you know?
Yeah.
If you wanted 200 to 300 people, I think that was their capacity. TT's was the room to play.
Yep.
Now, was there any time in between Runner and Township?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was about a year and a half, a little more than a year and a half. When I ended Runner, I didn't know if I was going to have another band. I didn't know what I was going to do. All I knew is that I didn't want the stresses of being the guy, of being a band. So I mean, I wasn't going to stop playing music or writing music. That never stopped. But in the interim, I started playing like bass in a trio with my good friends. Actually, the bass player who had been in the Zips with me, pre-Runner, was playing drums, and he just taught himself drums to play in this band, and it was super fun. And my friend Brad, who was in this awesome band in Boston called Fashion Cult from our Zips days, which is like, that band was awesome. So he was the songwriter and singer, and I played bass, and we were a trio, and we were really fun band. We were called Appletown Gun Shop, and it was super rehabilitative, I would say. We would just get together and have fun and just, you know, make really fun music and with no kind of parameters. And I loved playing the bass. It was really interesting to me. And we played good shows, actually, that kind of followed, even, and that sort of naturally followed. So I did that for a while. And just kept writing, or at least, you know, I say a while, but at least a year. Actually, I continued to do it when I started Township. But if Runner ended at April 2005, it was at the end of, oh my God, wait a minute. Yeah, I might have been less than a year before I started Township. Now that I think about it, I think it was very end of that year that I started jamming with Greg. The drummer who was in a band called the Cancer Conspiracy. And I think it was Jim Zawadowski that said, hey, you know, Greg's in town and he's looking to maybe start a new band. You should play with him. And we got together and I'd had a bunch of songs at that point. Jeez, I think that was, yeah.
What was the, right. What was it, the same guys at the beginning? I know Alejandro wasn't there at the beginning, but was the other guys were all the same? Can you talk about how you guys all hooked up and got together?
Sure. the two constant members have been me and John Sheeran, the bass player. So I knew Greg. I was introduced to Greg, and we started jamming. And he's like, "Oh, you want to start a band?" I said, "Well, okay, you know, I'll try it." His drumming style was different than anything I'd ever played with before, and I thought that was pretty interesting, kind of in a challenge sort of sense. It's like, okay, this will push me to be a little different, so I'm not doing the same sort of thing. And I was in communication with Jason Gillis, who was playing in a local band called Radar Eyes at the time, and he was a Runner fan, so I got to know him through that a little bit. And then he kind of asked me, I was starting to help out on some Radar Eyes stuff after Runner. I was like, I think I was playing keys for him, but he played bass in that band, but he also played some guitar. So I told him about my band. It's like, you know what? I'll help you out with Radar Eyes if you want to come help me out with this new band I'm doing. He's like, okay. And he said, you know, I have this friend, John, who plays guitar. Who was in the band Spitz. And he's like, you know, but he'd probably play bass if you asked him, if he liked it. So we brought John along, and that was all probably in the beginning of January, I think. And that was it. That was the, no, yeah, there was no really.
2006? 2006? Yeah.
Yeah. So then Mike from Runner recorded our first EP for us. our plan was to release the EP at our first show and kind of hit the ground running. And so that was, yeah, that was April 2006.
Okay, now a lot happened really quickly because I wasn't, I heard about all this from afar. In fact, I was wondering when I heard this band, the Family Township, I think you were going by the Family Township at this time, won the BCN Rumble when it was still a BCN. I was like, who the hell are those guys? Because I hadn't heard, and I didn't know until after someone told me that you were in the band. Oh, the guy from Runners in that band. Oh, okay. But you guys got really busy. Now, do you remember how the buzz grew so fast where you ended up even getting into the Rumble that quickly? Because your first album didn't come out until after that, right?
Yeah, no, our first actual full length was funded by our Rumble winnings.
Coming home, was that the?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, you know, we released our first EP in 2006, and I think my kind of Runner connections and Greg's Cancer Conspiracy connections, we were able to get some decent shows, and we immediately kind of played a lot. How did we catch the? Because also, you know, we released another EP before that album. So I think at the end of, right before the Rumble, we released another EP. No, that was right during the Rumble, the self-titled EP. It must have been Shred. I mean, the connection has to be Shred. I can definitely say Shred was on the radar because he was probably still doing his local show.
Well, yeah.
So we got him everything, and he was playing all that stuff. So he invited us to play the Rumble. So, and yes, we were unknown. We had been a band for a year at that point. So some people knew, but I think it caught a lot of people by surprise because they hadn't had a chance to see us before because it had only been a year. But yeah, it had to have been Shred who asked us. And then, but we kind of knew, we're like, all right, we're going to, after we won the first night, we're like, okay, we're going to take this really seriously and really try and win this thing.
Do you remember who was in the in it with you that year? Like who the finals were?
The final was Baker.
Tom Baker? Kind of like
a, no. They were a three-piece sort of pop rock band. They were really good, like good songs.
Oh, the band Baker. Yeah, I remember them.
Yeah.
The band and Baker. Then,
there was sort of like a hip-hop rock band called Indefinite Article, maybe. Yeah, I think that was another final. I think there was also a band called Kid Napkin or something. But yeah,
that it was still BCN though back then.
Yeah, it was BCN, and like the prices were insane.
Yeah,
like that we got like insane. Like I was just telling my son the other day, because he's a drummer, and he's like, oh, I think I like Sabian cymbals. And I was like, well, you know, when we won the Rumble, like one of the prizes was the drummer got to go to like the Sabian factory and pick out a whole set of cymbals. That's like, you know, that's over $1,000 right there. And no, yeah, it was awesome. It was awesome. Like I said, we financed our first record through all the recording and mixing and mastering and t-shirts and promo campaigns and everything. It was awesome. It was really cool. It was, you know, it's definitely designed to give the band that wins it a big push to the next level.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I was just gonna say, unfortunately, that feels like that era of kind of how a band progresses was maybe at an end, you know, or coming to an end.
Yeah, no disrespect to the current Rock and Roll Rumble, but I managed a few bands that were in the Rumble before 2007, and there was the winning prize was like $3,000 in studio time and all these studios and equipment and free ads in magazine. It was like, there's your marketing plan for the next year, you know? So that must have been a good thing for you guys.
Oh, it was huge. It was like, here you go. Like, you know, take this and don't waste it. And we didn't. We used every single prize, and we busted our butts and I think we got as much out of it as we could, besides, a record deal.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you guys made a bunch of records. I'm going to talk about a few of those with you right now. But did you do any touring with Township?
We did. We did any sort of like supporting bigger bands were always like small runs. We weren't like touring the country as, so-and-so's opening act, really. It was very DIY. And I liked that also because, one, we didn't really have much of a choice. It's not like we weren't going for bigger things, but also after the runner experience, I wanted to build it from the beginning. I wanted to experience all those firsts again in a way. Mm-hmm. And like, it was also different for me. I think like Renner only had a very short period of like, of kind of really scrapping it and sleeping on floors and stuff. It was pretty quickly that we were a three piece. So it was easier to afford a motel room and things like that. But,
and when you're younger, you can sleep on floors and it's a lot easier.
Yeah. I think our touring days kind of, came to a screeching halt. I think it was based around a 2010, I want to say, South by Southwest run. No, it had to be. Yeah, I think it's 2010.
Oh, you went to South by Southwest with Township?
Yes. Yes, we did. And we booked a 5-week, we did a 5-week tour, and that almost killed us. I mean, there was a lot of interpersonal things were coming up, a lot of alcohol abuse, and it all kind of, put into perspective where things needed to go at the end of that tour. So it was a good experience. I mean, looking back now, of course, there's lots of hilarity and fun stuff and maybe some good music. Hard to say, like playing that hard every night was, you can only do that for so long. Cause we played really hard.
There weren't really any big lineup changes except for Alejandro coming. When did he come into the band?
He came in the end of 2009. So he actually was our fourth guitar player at that point.
What? Really?
Yeah. So Jason Gillis, who started the band with us, it was always his plan. He was moving to Los Angeles with his girlfriend at the end of 2006. That was always their plan. We knew that there was like a window with him. So then my friend Carter took over because he had a band. I think I was in his band too. We were kind of doing the mutual thing like I was doing with Jason. He had a band called Tulsa that I played guitar and keys in, and he's like, well, I'll play guitar with you guys. So it's Jason Gillis is on the first two EPs. Carter played with us in the Rumble, and he's on the first full length record, and he sings a song. He's got one of his own on there. And then he kind of wanted to, we knew his time was limited too. So he went off to focus on his own thing. And I kind of went full Township. And so then we had Maddie Smart, who was Greg's friend from up in New Hampshire, who was a really gifted like blues guitar player. So we're like, well, this would be interesting. And I don't think he'd ever really been in a band like ours. And he uprooted his life. He came down. Had him living in my little apartment in Brighton, and he made the best of it. So he was with us on the next two records, but then we could tell he was kind of wearing out. It was wearing him down. So around, I think it's around 2009, I want to say that in November, I think it was around then that Alex came to see us at TT's. We had played with Ben Camaro at least once before, so we kind of knew each other a little bit. But yeah, I think he joined the end of 2009, maybe 2010.
I know.
And
Let's see. I mean,
yeah.
I tried to find everything, but I think you guys put a lot of, you know, Coming Home,
Yeah.
self-titled, Volume One, Live at Mad Oak. That was a good one. Was that Benny Grotto
It
that recorded that?
was, yeah. Yep. Yeah, that was awesome. That was a really fun experience.
Yeah, you guys were really had several years where you were actually doing really great. From afar, I noticed that. The One More Summer record was the one that I really got into it. Bringing up Thin Lizzy again, it gave me a real Thin Lizzy kind of vibe. Not that you're copying or anything, but you could hear the influences, you know what I mean? And then, you know, Alejandro to me is like one of the, you know, really good guitar player. I mean, everything he does is so good. And it seems like the band really started coming together at that time. Now, was there a break in between that and that EP you did with Ed V, or did you guys take a break?
There's sort of it took a break in the sense when I talk about that tour in 2010, that really kind of like made some pretty big fractures. Then throughout 2010, it seemed like we weren't going to be able to go forward with Greg the drummer, and then we started auditioning kind of other drummers in 2010, and sort of settled on Peter McLean.
Who you knew from childhood.
And he brought a totally different style. So we knew things were going to change, but really that was, there was a period of time where it was just Alex and me and John in the practice room, kind of writing each night, getting to know each other. Because when Alex joined, like we were a busy band. He learned all the songs and we went on the road and we played those songs, and we didn't really have time to really write yet or practice. So that's where, you always want to work to people's strengths. And he's Alex. It's like hearing him play and having that resource all of a sudden, like it just, that album really, like the songs really came together in a, I'm really proud of that record. I love that record.
One More Summer, is that the one you're talking about? Yeah, that's a,
Yeah.
these are all good. You guys are consistent. Now, let me ask you about your songwriting process because you brought that up. Did those guys, I mean, I guess you all write the music to there, but you're the lyricist pretty much, right?
Yeah, yep.
So what happens? They like record, they get the song, the music together, and then you add the lyrics?
Now it's like, I guess the last few years it's been actually, yeah, for a while it's sort of been like they've got a demo of a song and they'll give it to me, and I'll take it and I'll listen to it usually in the car or whatever, and just get melodies and then lyrical ideas. Yeah, and it, I love it. I mean, writing with those guys, it's really inspiring and it's really easy. I feel like to like, all I have to do is just like listen to this music. I don't have to worry about creating the whole thing. And it'll take me to a different place. So yeah, that's usually how it works with their songs.
So John, Peter, James Rohr is pretty much a core member of the band now too. Yeah, he's been on a bunch of records. I see his name out there. He's a really good keyboardist. And Alec, those guys pretty much record the demo and they give it to you. What do they do in the studio, in the rehearsal space, and just.
Yeah, I mean, we all have home recording setups in some form or another. But even some, even from this latest record, the Cross the Line song, John, I think that was just a little phone recording that John had that he gave to me. But normally, like, they'll work up, Alex will work up something in his studio. So it's really, really fully formed in song shape. I don't, we might tweak the arrangement or something like that, but and John's stuff will usually come, maybe it might be in its full form, or it might be like sort of the equivalent of a verse and a chorus or something like that, and I'll get to arrange it. And then there'll be times too where I'll take excuse me, some of my songs and I'll send them to those guys with blank spots for them to fill in. But yeah, the meat of it is usually there to get me inspired and to see where it'll go.
This record is just, I'm just going to fast forward here to the new record.
Sure.
Because I know the pandemic probably caused you guys problems like it caused everyone else, because we all missed a little bit of time. It's hard to believe that, you know, it seems like 2020 was like, you know, wow, it's snowing like crazy out. Sorry, I got a little distracted when I looked out my window. I'm near Worcester, so I'm a little central mess right now. Anyways, I didn't mean to do that, but ADD. This record, okay, you mentioned the song Cross the Line, Oh Andrea. Now, I know your wife is Andrea Gillis, because even though we may have met in passing, I know Andrea very well, because there was a time around 2003 and 4 where I was doing a lot with the Abbey Lounge. So, and Andrea was like one of the mainstays at the Abbey Lounge. So I imagine you wrote the lyrics about your wife.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's sort of like our origin story. But it was John's, that's John's music, that he had, you know, that was John's first verse chords and chorus chords. And it kind of clicked just listening to the car, like it kind of clicked. But then I did like check with them. Sorry, I think I sent them a text or something. I was just like, you know, would you guys be comfortable if this, if I'm singing about, you know, directly singing like a love song about my wife, like with her name actually in it? And they were like, you know, obviously, if that's the way it came out, then awesome. Then go for it.
Andrea deserves a song about her. Definitely.
I agree. more than one.
Now, you did this with Westner over at Minahan Studio, right?
This one we did with Westner at a different studio.
The
one before we did the bulk at Woolly Mammoth with Westner, but this one he also works out of a studio near Plymouth. It's got a funky name, I forget the name of it.
I was looking at the Bandcamp page and it doesn't say the studio, so I just assumed because it was Dave.
Oh,
Westner.
Sounds interesting. That's what it's called. And I believe the owner of it was in Bird Songs in the Mesozoic, I think.
Oh,
and I think did some commercial work and stuff, but it's right next to a horse farm, or it is a horse farm. So it's a really beautiful little setting out there.
I think I know the guy you're talking about, and I can't recall his name. Not Roger Miller, Eric.
I should know because I've met him a
I
few
should
times.
Too.
It sounds about right.
Bird Songs is a
nice guy.
Yeah, Bird Songs is a very strange band, but really, really interesting band, you know.
Yeah.
Roger Miller from Mission of Burma. Getting back to the record, though, when I, you know, it came out in November, and I'm going to talk about this in my intro. If I had heard it sooner, it would have been in our top 10 records of the year, because when I heard Youngblood, man, did that come off the – that hit me so hard. I was like, wow, this is one of the best songs, man. And you must have felt that. You put it first on the record.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I've always had immediate connection with that one. That one is a, that's a really good example of like Alex had that one. The music all worked out, and he actually had a folder full of songs. This is probably pre-pandemic, actually. I'd say 80% of the songs on this record are pretty much written within the last year. But there's a couple that we had worked on, Alex, John, and myself, maybe maybe 2018 or 19. And Alex had a folder full of songs, and I just kind of went through them every day on my annoying drive to work and wrote lyrics and melodies, and that one just blasted out. Like, that one just felt really natural, and I've always loved that song. So when it came time to do the record, deciding what songs, and you know, I had X amount of songs, and I was just like, you know what, if we're going to put out, let's say we never put out another record again, I would love that. This song needs to be a, you know, get a wider audience, because we put a version of it up on we had a project called DDX during Township, but sort of where we're kind of taking a break, where it's much more experimental. And we just kind of have a Bandcamp page where we put up ideas. And this was one from that project that I was just like, this song needs.
Oh, there's another version of it out there. Of course, I'll go look for that.
Yeah, look for DDX. It's out there. It's interesting.
DDX.
Yeah,
definitely.
I think we just have a Bandcamp page. Yeah, always like there's plenty of songs to cherry pick from that if we ever ran dry on material.
Did it take you guys a while to make this record?
Only because of scheduling, like life, it seems like life is always getting a little harder to schedule stuff around. So only that, it's like find a day where we can all spend a Saturday in the studio and we'll work out some songs. And then it'll be another 3-4 months before we can get back there, just scheduling wise. So we did that 3 times. So that period took about a year for 3 days of recording. but then beyond that, we have our home studios to finish stuff. Like James can do his keys at home and Alex can add stuff. But this one, we did a lot of it live, as I wanted. And a lot of the songs were new to the point where I was like the night before I was sending them to them or I'm showing them in the studio, which was pretty good for the energy. I think we would have never fathomed that idea years ago, but I think we're all pretty comfortable with each other and kind of like the idea that I really wanted to capture energy on this record, and the way to do that is live. And another way that can work or backfire is if the songs are really new, so people are really feeling it for the first time.
You succeeded. You definitely succeeded. The title, 20th Century Wasters, just how'd you come up with that?
I'm always thinking of silly, puns and with just like playing with words and like, but I've always, well, I think it probably started with the fact that there's always a part of me being like, man, I wish I was at the level where I could have my own 20th Century Masters. And I was like, and then I think like, oh, it's, and then I started to think like how do they find those band photos on those 20th Century Masters collections? Like, it seems like does every band, like, it's like they have to take a picture in front of like a gray background or something. And I don't know, I think I've spent too much time thinking about those collections. And then I was just like, I think me and James in particular, we always sort of like to not necessarily belittle what we do, but in a larger sense, or like our frustrations with music about how much you love it and then how much it's just like, I don't know, it can be a frustrating thing. And I don't know, it just popped into my head as like kind of a joke. Like we had a bunch of other, I mean, it is kind of a joke, but we had a few other titles, but I was just like, you know what? I keep coming back to this and it answers the question of what would the cover would look like. So that kills two birds with one stone, two things that like could delay the record from coming out.
Yeah.
And it's a little nod also to like, we're not young men, we're in our 40s. Some of us are in their early 50s. Like, this is a nod to kind of those older things. And it's sort of like make your own destiny a little bit, like I'm not going to have my own 20th Century Master. So I'll make my own. This is what it's going to be.
Is there a vinyl on this coming? Or is there a vinyl?
I hope so. The way we sort of operate as a band now is whatever money we make goes back into the band.
Mm-hmm.
So we've just now broken even on recording and costs and merch and all that sort of fun stuff. So at this point, the goal was at least to build up the bank again and make vinyl, because this would, it's sequenced for an A and a B side. That's the next plan, vinyl and then back in the studio.
I just thought of something that I didn't want to forget. I love the guy. He's been a guest on the show, Mike Peel. Now, was he just filling in, or is he now taking over for Peter?
He's taking over. He has taken over.
Wow. Yeah. So you got one of the best drummers around. No offense against Peter McLean, of course. But
no, that's our thing. We have to have the best drummers.
Yeah. You succeeded. So what's next now? Is there like touring? You set another record. I see you as someone that's probably going to be putting, I mean, how many total records do you have? Oh, quite a few. Quite a few.
That I've been a part of, yeah, I think for sure. It's been a lot.
Got to be close to 20.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, if I, yeah, maybe.
So is there going to be any more tour dates? I know you guys did a big show in Boston when the record came out. Is there anything coming up?
Nothing coming up. We're kind of in the planning stages. I know. I think we're going to do a live in studio, down in Jersey City at FMU.
Oh,
I think
nice.
we're gonna. I think that's in April. Piecing together a few dates around there. As for a local date, we haven't landed on a next local date yet. But, yeah, we're kind of we're in the planning stages of seeing how we want the rest of the year to go, but we've got a few things peppered in there. And then, of course, like I've been writing a bunch, so that's starting to get distracting because now I'm getting like, well, I'd love to hear how these sounds recorded with the band.
Well, Mark, thank you so much, man, for taking. I call him. I don't know why I call. Everyone else calls him Alec. I call him Alejandro. I just like saying
Oh, yeah.
Alejandro Necochea.
Oh, absolutely. That's how I introduce him on stage.
You
And yeah, I go back and forth for sure.
And you know, I approached him and I said, "You think Mark would do this?" He's like, "Yes, get in touch." So thank you, Alec, if you're listening out there, and
Man.
thank you, man, for coming on, and I wish you best. I
Thanks.
really love this record a lot. It made me
Thank
go
you.
back, and now I have to really go back and really revisit the entire catalog. That's what I'm going to do. And I already
Nice.
listened to the live thing, and I was like, wow, that's great, you know? And
Yeah.
so I got to go. And One More Summer I knew about, but some of the other records I need to go revisit. And but thank you
There's
so much.
no, thank you, man. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
All right, man. Cross the Line. Oh, Andrea, it's a love song. What can I say? That's from the Family Township's new album, 20th Century Wasters. Mark Pinanski, really nice guy, very honest about where he's been, where he's going, everything that happened. You can feel the authenticness in his songs as well. It was a pleasure having Mark on the show. If you haven't heard that new Township record that I've been raving all about, go check it out. You can actually listen to it on Bandcamp, and then after you fall in love with it, you can buy it and listen to it over and over again. All right. Speaking of enjoying stuff like I've been enjoying this, I hope you guys are enjoying the show. You can write me anytime at twistedrico@gmail.com. If you're a musician or a songwriter and you have music, please send it over. You might hear it here. You might even hear it on the Mirror Stars podcast. We also have an Instagram page, Facebook threads, YouTube page. We can actually watch the Zoom interview I did with Mark Pinanski. There's also a TikTok page at Twisted Rico where you can watch clips from the show. And also, please supporting this podcast on our Patreon page, which is patreon.com/TwistedRico, where you can support us for only $1 a month. All right, that's going to do it for this one. Till the next time we say goodbye, this is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. Keep the rock and roll alive.